we got a lot to get into today. A lot of meat on the bone. First overall picks getting benched. First overall pick signing contract extensions. Interview with DeMar DeRozan, who I got a chance to sit down with last Friday. Waited. It wasn't a time-sensitive interview, all right? It was after work on Friday, and yesterday I want to talk about the NFL. And then possibly a franchise-altering comeback. Flat out. That's the only way to describe what happened last night in the Monday Nighter. But yeah, I want to start with Sid because he deserves it. He's the greatest player of the cap era. He deserves our attention. He deserves our love. He deserves our respect. He's a man. He's absolutely the man. He did the thing that everybody wants their best players to do, which is take a sweetheart deal. Guy signs a two-year extension with the Penguins carrying an 8.7 AAV. So he signed this year already to that same number. So the two-year extension takes him through his 38 and 39 seasons. He's a Penguin for life. Maybe he plays when he's 40. Maybe he goes to another team. But this feels like this is the end of his post-prime. Like, yeah, I don't know. Sidney Crosby, I'm not going to doubt him. He is very much to me the LeBron of hockey, where he's aging like a fine wine. He still hasn't taken that step back. But we just saw it with Ovechkin last year. It can happen quick. And this is what always what happens in pro sports. Everybody thought, oh, Tim Duncan, he's never going to age. And then all of a sudden, he's aging. Oh, well, Patty Kane, he's going to be incredible for years to come. All of a sudden, just not the same player anymore. So I got to assume that 3 more years, 37, 38, 39 with the Penguins, that's going to be the end of Sidney Crosby. Anybody that had any dreams about him, you know, going to Colorado or trying to chase a cup ring with somewhere else, or that Pittsburgh not being competitive enough, that this was going to stifle their chances of keeping him. We all look like fools. I remember I talked to Frank Saravelli and Elliot Freeman about this last year around the deadline when the Penguins were really stumbling around. And I thought maybe this guy just wants to win so badly that he would forsake being a Penguin for life. No, it doesn't even happen. Not only that, he puts his money where his mouth is, and he gives Kyle Dubas a better shot at winning by taking the 8.7. It's the cutest thing ever. It's so cute. This is 8.7. This guy loves his birthday. It's like this guy and Taylor Swift are just obsessed with their birthdays. And he's just 8.87. 8.7, 8.7, 8.7. That's the only number that I'm going to accept. That's the only number I want. I can't imagine being this guy's agent and thinking, please, man, like, can we just get a little bit more than this? 8.7? And you know what I think is interesting about his legacy? It's reflected in this contract, which is Crosby won. Like, he genuinely won after signing major contract extensions, like UFA contract extensions. 2016, like, I think still, as great as McDavid's run was this past year, and as much as people were like, this is the best run, this is the greatest run, and he was piling up points and he was dominant offensively, Sid in 16 is as good as I think I've ever seen a hockey player play. Just a complete, well-rounded, unbelievable game, top to bottom, every night. He was just killing everybody. Just obliterated the Sharks. They showed up for that series, and it was just over. They were beaten up, but Sid was just on it, man. He was just incredible. He put his money where his mouth is, and, you know, he doesn't speak very often, but, and I've referenced this before, but I remember him doing an interview with Spit and Chicklets where he opened up about taking the 8.7, the cute, 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 cute birthday number. I love my birthday. Yes, he loves his birthday. But he talked about how he knew he needed to take less in order to make sure that Malkin would do the same. And he wasn't even sure Malkin was going to do the same thing. He hadn't said, I'm going to take less if you take less. He took a shot. He did the thing. And Gino ended up falling in line. And it really helped set Pittsburgh up for their second wave of Stanley Cups. Their second wave of going after and getting into championship games. And yeah, Malkin eventually, you know, gets old, and Sid is, I think, pretty damn near close to the same player. It's pretty unreal how good he has been able to, like, maintain his game. But yeah, the Penguins have had a lot of roster turnover. It's clearly not the same groups around him, but he's maintained the same thing. And now here he is with a team that, frankly, is not in a great cap situation and he bails him out. He could have asked for more. Like, it's Sidney Crosby. Who's to deny him of double digits on this contract? And you look at just like all the money that he's left off the table to try to win. And my point looking back there is it was effective. It worked. Like, it worked. We know it worked. If you are one of the best players on the planet and you take a significant haircut on a contract, God, it's like, it's one of the biggest advantages you can have. I actually think, you know, when you're looking at this with through the lens of in the NFL right now, it's the rookie quarterback, right? Hey, you got a quarterback on a rookie deal, the CJ Stroud effect, where you can just put so much around your roster because you've got a quarterback who is on an incredible deal and he's ready to win right away, ready to win right out of the gate. That's kind of like the number one market efficiency. In the NHL, not too many times where guys are on rookie deals. Like, we thought that with the Leafs. We really looked at them and said, hey, they're all on rookie contracts. Maybe the Leafs are going to win in this window. It's tough to do. It's tough to come into the NHL and win in your first couple of years. Like, look at the battle that McDavid is having right now, one of the world's best players in a league where the world's best players win. I think that's it. It's still always going to be this. And obviously, we've talked about the players that have done it in markets where they're getting huge tax rebates, but ultimately, those guys are still making as much money as their peers, which is part of the unfairness of these narratives, right? Like, when we see Braden Point sign a contract extension and then you break down the math and he's actually making more money than a guy like Mitch Marner is on that deal. And you go, well, that seems unfair that we're portraying it this way. But yeah, if you're not in Vegas or in Texas or in Florida, we haven't really seen guys do this since the Bruins. The Bruins did it. They got one. And then they kept trying to chase it. They got to a couple more, but they never ended up closing the deal. So Bergeron did it. Marchand did it. But that's kind of changed now. You just saw the new contract come up for Pastrnak. He didn't take a haircut of a deal. Like, maybe, I mean, I guess slightly, considering that Nylander got more than him. And I do not think Nylander is a better player than Pastrnak. I really don't know who's making that case. In fact, it was kind of the only case against Nylander's deal was that he ended up getting like a marginal percentage point higher than Pastrnak's deal was. But Sid, like I mentioned the LeBron thing, it's a little strange to me that in the NHL, and I get it, there's different circumstances. Like, these guys aren't making nearly as much money, and you never really fault someone for getting the bag, and they're so like underpaid compared to other professional athletes. Like, it's not the same as with the NBA deals. It's not the same with NFL quarterback deals. And those guys are getting tons of money too. And you could say, like, oh, well, JD, like, a lot of these quarterbacks, why don't they follow Tom Brady and do the same thing? Like, Brady left a ton of money on the table. Don't see a lot of current NFL QBs doing the same thing. Fair, fair, fair. But like, LeBron in the NBA, when he was the most influential player, and again, him and Sid like basically line up the same way, he was the one who said, yeah, I don't care about, well, actually, he did care about the optics, but he forwent the optics and he decided to go to Miami. He left his team and he said, you know what? I'm going to make a big three. I'm going to put together my own superstar team. And the rest of the league sort of followed suit. The Kevin Durants of the world were like, yeah, yeah, I'll leave Oklahoma City. I'll go up to Golden State. He took it to the extreme. But for a while, you saw all these players around the NBA starting to try to put together their own big threes, right? If you follow the league, if you follow the NBA, you remember there was like a real period. Now we're kind of moving away from it because we're going back to depth and leagues zag and leagues change. But there was a real moment where it was, hey, you got to get together your big three. You got to get your big three. You got to get your big three. And I'm just kind of surprised that there's never been a guy that looked at Sid and said, yeah, I'm going to do it that way. Like, McDavid famously left off $1 million, which is still a big deal on his first contract, right? Like, that's the story, is he went back, he had already agreed to the deal, and then he was like, no, I got to take a little bit off this. If there was anyone that I was guessing was going to change and decide to take a little less later in their career, it will certainly be McDavid. Like, I don't think he's going to go his entire career going, yeah, I'm getting the max amount of money. Kudos to Auston Matthews. He's making a ton. He's setting up his contracts this way, but I would imagine that that's going to be the way he is for like his entire career. Like, he's always going to be like, yep, I'm going to sign these short-term deals at the max amount of money. Pay me, which is his right. But that in a cap league where it's so hard to win and there are so few advantages now, where there's so many players that are really good and so many teams that are deep, and you got the most physically grueling postseason out of any sport, that no one has modeled Sid. No one listened to Sid say that. No one went, huh, like maybe this is the way that you do it. Maybe having a couple less million dollars in the bank is worth having a Stanley Cup. And it sucks that that's the position that you're in. Obviously, I've been very anti-cap throughout my entire, you know, radio podcast tenure. I hate the salary cap. I think it's bad for fans. I think it's bad for the league. I think it's bad for players. I get it. The owners get their thing and they've convinced everybody like, oh, parity. And people have gobbled that up and they're like, oh, it's good. It's fair. We want to have the Utah team being around. We want Vegas to be a dynasty right out of the gate. It is what it is. It's a reality of the situation. I can't change it. You can always say, get your bag, King. But ultimately, Sidney Crosby led by example, and nobody's really followed. And it's still there. The template is still there. Be the leader of your team. Be one of the best players on the planet. He was the best player. Be the best player on your team. Take a little less. Make sure that the rest of your team falls in line financially, because they don't have the guts to fall out of line when it comes to the contract situations. No one wants to make more than Sidney Crosby. I mean, now they do, because God, this is just such a sweetheart deal. Like, this is way too low, not even taking a raise. But yeah, I really do look forward to seeing the first guy that decides to do this in a meaningful way, where he goes, you know what? I'm still going to be rich, richer than I ever dreamed. I want to win a Stanley Cup. Anyways, I had a chance to talk to DeMar DeRozan. Like I mentioned, I went down on Friday, I went downtown. I read his book. It's called Above the Noise. It's actually phenomenal. Like, we talk about the book in the interview. I kind of mostly did stick to the book, but yeah, I really enjoyed catching up with the guy. Here's our interview from this week.
A man who needs no introduction, except for the fact that he has now authored this book, Above the Noise. It's DeMar DeRozan. First of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I read it yesterday. It's really good, man. Mm. Like, it reminded me a lot of, did you ever read Jerry West's book?
I heard it was good. Yeah.
West by West reminded me a lot of this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you write very powerfully about your youth. It's very inspiring to listen to you about your craft. Mm-hmm. I think that it's very relatable when you're talking about your young adulthood. Mm-hmm. I think it's very brave how you've written about your mental health. And again, these were a lot of themes that were in his book as well. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say congratulations, because this is genuinely one of the best books that I've ever read by an athlete. West by West is my favorite book. And while I was reading it, genuinely couldn't put it down. Like, really, really great book, man. And I can't tell you that, like, you should be incredibly proud of this work. This is incredible. The question is, though, why now? Because most guys wait till the end of their careers to write a book. You're still very much in, you just signed a contract. Like, the Sacramento Kings probably saw you write this and they're like, hey, you're still playing, right? You're still showing up to camp?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you said, a lot of people wait until it's like their career is over, then do a book. And I think for me, like, just showing that life is such a journey, mm-hmm. And kind of like showing vulnerability, showing my flaws, showing growth, showing that I'm still going through things, and trying to unpack a lot of things and still learn in the midst of still playing. That's what it's like for all of us. A lot of guys just wait till you're done to express what it is, and you know, you still got life to live. And I kind of want to do and show both sides of it. You know, still want to show how much life I lived and the obstacles that I had to go through and still go through. In the midst of still playing at a high level, it was very important to try to, you know, explain, because you don't never get to see it from that perspective. And, you know, it was something I wanted to show.
Honestly, man, like, that's one of my favorite things in the book, is that when you're detailing kind of your experiences with therapy and, you know, your journey with mental health, that, again, I find it to be very relatable, which is one of the really cool things about this book, is, like, you know, you mentioned it a few times that, you know, a lot of people would look at you and be like, that's DeMar DeRozan. Like, that's someone that, it's hard to relate to you in the sense of you can fly over other human beings, mm-hmm. and dunk on them the way that you did on Chris Boucher, right? Mm-hmm. That's not relatable. You mentioned like the bank account not being relatable, you know, like many things about your life some people would dream upon, but when you write about stuff like, you know, your journey with therapy, that sometimes you relapse on it, you know, that you'll do it, you'll feel progress, you'll stop. That's something a lot of us go through.
Yeah.
When you challenge yourself to think about being vulnerable in front of a psychiatrist, that's just like most people's experiences. And so the fact that you are still going through this and that you are still playing, I actually think that it makes the book even more powerful than it would be, like you said, at the end of your career, that this is something that, you know, you're not fixed. You don't view yourself as a finished product just because there's a book here. This doesn't end your life. Mm-hmm. This is just who you are at this moment of it in that journey.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to describe it that
way? That's 100% what it is. You know, and I think that was the most important thing, because even still doing a book, it's so much other stuff I realize that I'm going through, that I have to go through, and that I have to kind of like deal with and break down and kind of fix, whether if it's some me personally or relationships outside of me. You know, it's much more deeper than what people may look at it like, you know, it's a book being done and that's the story.
Yeah.
You know, it's still so much more even within that's still, you know, evolving and still, you know, a work in progress, and just showing that, you know, who knows, it'd be another part. It's kind of like a part two to a movie, to where certain things happen in part two of a movie that makes sense from the first movie, that kind of correlate with certain actions. And, you know, that's basically what I'm just trying to get at and try to show is just breaking down, you know, those areas of things that, you know, mentally, emotionally, that I'm going through, that, you know, I'm trying to figure out too. So the book is like a therapeutic lesson that I'm still going through. You know?
And you know what though, I thought about that too, reading it, is, you know, you've had a lot of challenges in your life, and you are someone that is still going through therapy, and you are someone that's still going through a lot of, you know, challenges in your life. And when you were doing this, and again, I know that you've confronted a lot of things and it's cataloged throughout the book, but did you find it more challenging at times than therapeutic? Like, was it difficult for you to go over some of these things, especially with, like, you know, strangers?
Yeah, yeah.
And knowing that this stuff was going to be, like, out there, and you having to, like, really put yourself back in those places mentally.
100%. It's difficult. It's not a simple thing. It's hard. It's challenging. It opens up other doors you didn't think it'd open, as far as like emotions, you know, wounds, you know, it just kind of brings so much stuff to the light deeper within than, you know, what people may just read from the story, that kind of got to be addressed and handled. And this allowed me to kind of break those moments down and work on that going forward too, because it's not easy. I'd be the first to tell you it's one of the toughest things that I've done in my life, to be able to, you know, one, go back to a lot of memories that I had trauma from, and a lot of current memories that I'm still kind of, you know, working through.
Yeah, man, that's what, because again, like, so to relate to your book a little bit, you know, I lost my father a few years ago. I've also had some trauma in my childhood. I wouldn't relate it to what you had. But I found that when I've done therapy at times, that even though you get, like you write in the book, the aha moments, there are times where it just is too much.
Yeah.
Like, you have to just step back from it, because you're like, you know what? I thought I was ready to talk about this. I started to uncover this, but I'm just not ready to delve into some of whatever this pain is, and I need a break from it. Mm-hmm. But you're here with a book, mm-hmm. you know? Like, I'm assuming that they gave you some type of a timeline where you have to have this thing out. You've got, like, time commitments. Mm-hmm. Was there anything that was the hardest thing to do, was to be like, man, I gotta push through this today. Like, I can't just treat this like a therapy session. I gotta treat this like a book that I've promised to deliver on.
I feel like that now.
Yeah.
I feel like that now, to be honest with you, because, you know, it's a tough thing when usually when you feel any type of discomfort emotionally, or some feel like it's too much, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times you have the opportunity to kind of take a second, take a step back, kind of, you know, indulge in something else to help free your mind or recharge yourself, give you the strength and grace you need to jump back into, you know, what's important, you know, when you're consistently doing something that's that's as heavy as this and not even have the opportunity yet to kind of like work on the things that you talk about in the book or things that you may be going through in a book, it makes it extremely hard. You know, it makes it extremely tough because, you know, you just want to kind of block out the noise,
yeah,
in a sense, during the process. But, you know, I know once I get that moment, I'm definitely going to do that.
You going to do that in Wyoming? You going to do that in Montana?
No, I'm going to do it. I don't know which way I'm going to do it yet, yeah, but I know it'll be done.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so the nature therapy stuff, that's still working for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's always the best part of it. That's kind of like the extreme part of it when it's just, you know, you just want to just get away from everything and everybody, you know, working out, responsibilities, obligations, everything. You know, that's the go-to. That's kind of like the extreme,
yeah,
level of it.
Can I give you the next spot?
Where?
I'm from the north. Like, I'm from a place called Whitehorse, Yukon.
Uh-huh.
It's right by Alaska. Have you ever been to Alaska?
That's been my next stop. I've been wanting to go to Alaska, like, the last 2 or 3 years. I just haven't got a chance.
Dude, I'm telling you, like, when you were describing the scenes, mm-hmm, and the tranquility. Summer.
Yeah.
You're playing in the winter, but still. Do it in the summer.
Yeah.
Because it's brutal in the winter. But, yeah, I think that you would really enjoy that.
Alaska been on my list for the last 3 years.
I think that if this brings you calm, this brings you peace, there's a lot of places around there that still feel like very untapped part of the world. And, yeah, it's just a very cool and very interesting place. But, again, summertime.
I love it.
But you won't see the moon because the sun's up all night in the summer.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're not going to get a lot of time with the moon. But, yeah, so, you know, you're at USC, and that's when you start to unlock the what's next mentality. Am I right? Mm-hmm. That's when it starts to become, like, what's next with your career, or what's next with your game. When did this kind of become what's next? Like, are we here, actually, if it's not for the tweet? Like, if you don't do that tweet, do you end up in the same
1,000%
place? 1,000% no. So it's like, that's just like this one little hinge point moment in your life. Because but from reading it, it seemed like it was kind of, not an innocuous moment, that you were feeling powerful feelings, but that you kind of fired it off being like, yeah, whatever, this is just kind of like me giving a tiny little bit of a release.
Yeah, I mean, I know for a fact without that tweet, no.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be sitting here, I wouldn't be doing this. Who knows what turn it would have took, but I could honestly say I wouldn't be here without that. And it just shows you how funny life is, you know, how one, you know, I wouldn't never say a mistake, how one action can, you know, lead you down a whole nother path that's so unexpected. And, you know, I'm a bad planner in life because I don't like preconceiving anything. Like, I don't like planning because some of my greatest moments in my life came unplanned. So it makes me question when things are planned. Some people are great planners, and they need to be, you know, they need to plan out their week, their day.
I'm really
Yeah, for sure. But me, I hate planning. It gives me the utmost anxiety because I feel like through that planning, you could block something that could happen so unexpected and genuinely that'll come with more than me planning out something. Mm-hmm. So that's just how, like, my mind always works. So I always try to take everything moment by moment, day by day.
That's interesting because most people that have it that way, like, for me, I don't really like to plan because I got, like, the commitment issues with anything. Yeah. Like, I never want to commit to something because I'm like, man, if I decide to do that, then, then I've locked in, and if something else comes along, then I'm not going to be able
to do it. Yeah.
So I'd rather just leave it free, and then I can't disappoint anybody.
Right.
You know, like, nobody can be disappointed because I never made any promises, and I just agreed that I was going to be like, oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
And then you end up kind of having the thing. But I just thought that was crazy, that so much of this book is just like you late at night, you know, sitting there scrolling, sitting there on Twitter, and then firing off that tweet, and then it just has this absolutely massive effect where people are walking up to you in bookstores and grocery stores telling you about how much you've helped them. And I am kind of curious too about this. Like, I think that with some people that open up and are vulnerable this way and offer such a big part of themselves, that there is a large contingency of people that come to you and start to relate to you and be like, hey, Damar, like, I want to reach out to you because I'm feeling these same things. But then it can become kind of overwhelming because now you're trying to take on, or potentially taking on, the burdens of other people. And I'm curious, you know, how you think you're going to try to balance this moving forward, because you really have become a beacon for mental health.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the beauty of the journey, just accepting the journey and knowing what the journey is going to be, obstacles that you can learn from, you could grow from, that you kind of, you know, build up a different type of emotional and mental strength that you didn't have before, because now you know it's going to be a journey. You know, is you willing to take this marathon with everything that come with it to get to the end of it and realizing it's still a journey. You know, I think me more so accepting that part of it will make everything else easy, because, you know, once you do something like this, it, like I said, it opens up so many other emotional doors that you're going to have to deal with, because you open them up.
Yeah.
You know, when before you close them in because you don't want to deal with them. And I think this is just giving me an opportunity to express, make right, deal with a lot of things I kind of had closed off for a long time.
Do you find that you're finding peace in more places than basketball? Like, obviously family would be one.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, through a process like this, and, you know, you mentioned at the end of the book that basketball is still your sanctuary. Like, that mm-hmm. is still the place that you find peace. And I'm curious, like, going through a process like this and reflecting on all the things that are going on in your life, if there are other avenues that you're looking towards and going, you know what, this might be something.
Yeah, I don't necessarily look at it like, this goes back to, like, the planet. Like,
oh, yeah, I guess.
You know what I mean?
You just said that.
Yeah, it's more so, like, I read this quote one time and said, nothing's making sense. That's how I know I'm going to be okay. And that hits hard with me. And it's, like, a lot of stuff don't make sense right now for me. But that's when the greatest things for me always happen, when a lot of stuff didn't make sense, you know. That's why I talk about the story when I was traded from here. It was like, it didn't make sense to me in that moment, but it gave me a different type of approach, preparation, professionalism. It gave me a different type of appreciation for the game and for my career after that happened. I don't know if I would have had that if that moment didn't happen.
It seems like not.
Yeah.
Like, from reading the book, it seems like it was very much happened for a reason situation.
Exactly.
I will say this, reading it from your perspective, because, you know, you've been public about, you know, how much the trade from the Raptors hurt you. Like, pretty much from the outset, like, it was pretty public and everybody knew, you know, like, what this city meant to you and what you meant to the city. But reading through it, I was like, you know what, I think the Raptors are cursed now. I think that they traded their soul for the championship, they got it, and now... Like, reading this, I was like, this feels, like, very cursy moving forward from your perspective. I'm curious, though, too. Do you have peace with it now?
Like, for sure, yeah.
Is it, like, you're like, you know, this is good. Now
yeah.
It doesn't feel the same
way.
It doesn't
bother me. It don't sting. It don't nothing. Like I said, because so much more came out of that situation that, you know, sometimes when something don't make sense, you'll do something that make it make sense, you know, and I'm just a firm believer in that, so it don't bother me, it don't, you know, it happens, you know, it just happens that way, you know, and I move past it, it don't bother me. A lot of people think when I talk about it, it's like I'm bitter about it, I'm hurtful, it's like, nah, it ain't that. One, people always ask me about it, one, I'm gonna say, I don't want to talk about it, like, it's a part of what happened, but for me, It don't bother me.
Again, though, I think it makes you far more relatable as a person that you just say things the way that you did feel them rather than put out the pretend, the facade that it's
And that's the thing, even with the book, it's like people get so caught up in what people may think or what they may feel because you expressing your feelings.
Yeah.
Only you know your true feelings towards something, and that's what it should be. Don't let somebody else thought towards your feelings make you keep your feelings in. You know what I mean? That's just what it was. It's just what it was. And from that, just the strength that I have now from that moment, because when it first happened, I didn't think I'd feel the way I feel to this day. But that shows the growth and how much I gained from that happening that I didn't even know that was there. So much come from it.
Last question. I know you said you don't plan. I know you said you don't want to have the thoughts and the plans. But would you be open to retiring as a Raptor?
Oh, yeah. You always want a poetic ending of that way. You know, and, like, granted, most people don't get to write their own ending.
Mm-hmm.
But what a better ending than, you know, being able to end where you start. But not just end by just putting on the jersey. Yeah. I still, it have to be in a sense of me still being myself.
You gotta play.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't do the ceremonial.
No. Okay. I wouldn't just do the, you know, I wouldn't want to come back and be Olajuwon or nothing like that. Like, you know, it have to just, you know, make sense. You know, I definitely, you kind of want to go out like you came in a sense, and that's what people kind of, you know, remember you as.
I really hope it happens, man. I do. And I think the city would love it, too. Again, the book is Above the Noise, DeMar DeRozan. It was a pleasure meeting you. It was a pleasure getting to chat with you. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. Appreciate it, brother.
It was a real pleasure finding out, as I roll that interview, that my lav mic didn't get turned on and that only his mic was on. That was good. Anyway, no, I really enjoyed that conversation, man. Honestly, it's pretty easy to tell when you're talking to him why he's so beloved and liked in this city, right? Like, why he has been covered the way that he has, why so many media members have felt like, an attachment to him, when your job is to try to, in some ways, be disconnected from the athlete, like in from an emotional or a friendship level. There's a reason why they got the journalists to fly on different planes, right? They didn't want the fraternizing. And yet DeMar is just the kind of guy where, yeah, you sit down with him even for a few minutes, you're just having a chat with him off the air. And it's just, he's a relatable, normal, interesting guy. Thoughtful. I highly recommend the book. I really do. I'm not just saying that because he sat down and did the interview. I read it beforehand. I'll be honest, I've read a lot of athlete biographies that I didn't think were overly compelling or that I thought were rushed. Exaggerated, maybe, which is fine. That's any good storyteller. I exaggerated. His book was genuinely one of my favorite sports biographies I've ever read. I tore it up cover to cover, probably read it all in a couple of days. Like, I couldn't put it. I was like, I have to read this, because if you're going to do those interviews properly. And so I didn't literally touch on a lot of the Raptor stuff. It's all been done before. Like, I get it. I don't fault anybody else that's doing that interview. And I don't fault anybody else that's getting, you know, that information from him or those kind of clips from him. But like, I only kept it to like one or two Raptors questions, because I've heard his answers on them before, and I just know how that goes. So I want to read the book, and to my surprise, like, I shouldn't say my surprise, but I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. It is a really, really compelling book. And, you know, I speak for myself anyways, is that, you know, you hear about a guy like him who has like a mythos around him, right? He's got the nickname Debo, and, you know, it comes from Compton. And we have, I would say, like, if you're around my age, you grew up with a lot of music coming from that area. And so you kind of glamorize it. I certainly have over the course of my life. And not to say that I didn't think that it came with hardships. I wasn't delusional. I'm not a complete idiot, just a slight idiot. But there's a glamorizing that happens with that through music, because that's our real only window into it, and storytelling. And to read his book, and especially through the eyes of a child, like, there's real heartbreaking moments in it. Like, it's really difficult to sit there and take it all in and go, damn, you really made it out of this. Like, anyway, I highly recommend it for any fan of DeRozan, for a sports fan. And frankly, I just think it's a book that you could read as a human being and enjoy it. So anyways, thanks to DeMar for sharing his story. I really do think that there's a lot of, I think we could again agree that there's a lot of like virtue signal-y stuff when it comes to mental health these days. Like, I know that, you know, we're supposed to be more open-minded to people sharing their stories, but that, come on, like, who among us hasn't rolled their eyes at the odd thing going like, really, this is what you're going to throw this under? Like, the guise of mental health on this thing. But I think anybody who's had like those issues, those struggles, knows that even still, it's not the easiest thing to open up about, because you do fear that, like, oh wait, well, maybe my thing isn't worthy enough. Maybe the thing isn't valid enough, especially in like online culture, where it always seems like you can, you know, one up somebody. And it's what's the term? It's like competitive trauma. Like, people have that where it's like, well, this is worse than that, and this is worse than this. So you go up and, like, it's a hierarchy of who's had it worse. But, you know, I still think for a guy like this who's in the league to be writing his story and putting pen to paper and opening up about, you know, his marriage and his children and his upbringing and, you know, his state of disappointment throughout his career and the ups and downs and the highs and lows. I think it's very brave. I do. I don't think that this is the, you know, a kind of a run-of-the-mill thing that this guy has done. And, you know, as I mentioned in the interview, I think that it's clearly had a large impact on people. It's absolutely resonated and had an impact throughout the league. And as much as, you know, DeMar DeRozan's legacy is always going to be one of the more entertaining players to watch in the league, a high flyer, a guy who developed some of the best footwork in the NBA, a guy who, you know, was a great person, I think that the thing that will last for him, at least to me anyways right now, is this stuff, is that, you know, he's probably changed the way that the NBA, I don't even think probably, he's absolutely changed the way that the NBA approaches mental health, a way that a lot of the players around the league speak about it. And yeah, I think that he is a great champion for that cause. So yeah, credit to DeMar DeRozan. And also, I just want to say too on this, I didn't bring up the stuff about, like, the championship and the Raptors run and all this difference, because, like, I saw it on, like, Stephen A's show and all these other clips that were kind of flying around. And I'm sure that, you know, he's promoting a book, so I'm sure he's on, like, a lot of other podcasts. I didn't listen to anybody else's interview. That's just not my style. I don't really like to – I don't like to listen to other people do an interview, or same thing, really. Like, I don't listen to a lot of sports podcasts because I don't want to be influenced by them. I know there's a lot of better sports podcasters than myself. And so I go, yeah, I don't want to hear it from someone smart and better, because then I'm just going to parrot your take and it's not going to be authentic. It's going to be bad. But I saw the clip about the Raptors championship run, and like, he took a lot of flack for it. And I just don't know what you would expect him to say. Like, he's a proud professional athlete who, you know, tried to improve his game every single year. That was his calling card. And we mentioned in the interview, it's like, when he's at USC, he started asking himself what's next. And he kept developing his game and taking one step after another. And here he's asked questions like, do you think the Raptors would have won with you in the championship? And you think he's going to say no? You think he's going to say, you know, Kawhi was just so much better than me. I can realize it. Like, well, no, of course not. And why wouldn't he think that? Like, yes, the Raptors were incredibly close in these series. And did Kawhi bail them out, especially in the Sixers series? Like, absolutely no doubt about it. Do they win a championship, in my opinion, with DeMar instead of Kawhi? No. But, like, it was a little disappointing the way that they played against the Sixers. Like, the rest of the team was terrible. And in his mind, he's probably thinking, like, yeah, you know what? I would have been more of a distributor than Kawhi. I would have got other people involved. I could have scored 25, 30 a game. I could have poured in a bunch of points. I would have, like, we would have won. We would have beat them. We'd have beat the Bucks. And then you play a Warriors team that, yeah, frankly, wasn't fully healthy. And I think we all can acknowledge that. Like, it doesn't diminish the championship, but it's just a reality. LeBron had left. He was very clear about that. I don't love that mentality throughout the league where it was like, yeah, LeBron's out of the East. Like, we can finally have a different champion. But LeBron's one of the greatest players, if not the greatest player who ever laced him up. So hard to really hate on that too. But yeah, I find it odd that it became such a major talking point when it's like the most stock athlete answer ever is like, do you think you could do the thing? Like, yes. Again, read this guy's book and see what he came from and how he made it to the league. He's got self-belief. You kind of have to have it to be that guy in that league. So yeah, this is my two cents on that. I didn't bring it up with him, because I didn't care, and I also didn't want to sound like, you know, I didn't want to be like, oh yeah, I think you could have done it too. But I don't know what the other answer is. Like, I didn't really get that. Goes viral, it does, because that's what happens. You get reactions. But yeah, anyway, I got no issue with it. Anyway, subscribe to this podcast, leave 5 stars. The interview's gonna be up on YouTube if you want to watch it. Hit the thumbs up there, do all those things. It really helps the show when you leave a review. Follow on Twitter and Instagram. Posted some photos of DeMar and I there too, at JD Bunkus. And we'll take a quick break and we'll talk about a first round pick that gets benched and a big money quarterback that avoids it. That's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, so big things in the NFL yesterday. What a lame setup that was. Bryce Young gets benched for Andy Dalton. The first overall pick in last year's draft. Last year's draft on a Carolina Panthers team that was going absolutely nowhere, that can't sell a ticket, that has a fan base that's completely in shambles. Like, it's them and the Chicago White Sox for who you would least want to be in professional sports right now. Like, there's just no doubt about it. They're in sports hell. They have just nothing to point to. I watched the Dave Canales clips of him talking about the decision, and they're like, this is still Bryce's team, and, you know, let's give us a step back to try to get the things in order. And I saw a couple people around the NFL doing the whole, like, well, this is good for him because he'll get some time. It's over. It's done. They just made their decision on the first overall pick in last year's draft, two games into the season. And frankly, I don't really blame him. I don't think he's an NFL quarterback. I think this is an all-time miss. It's going to go down as one of the worst trades in sports history. Like, there's just no doubt about it. Lucky for the Browns fans, because this gives them a tiny bit of cover for the Deshaun Watson trade. They're like, oh, we're hiding out. Because this one's a little bit more splashy because he's a first overall pick and it ends up turning into a first overall pick. It's also kind of funny that two of the best redemption stories in all of football right now, Baker Mayfield and Sam Darnold, were both just wearing Panthers jerseys. Like, the Panthers could have had Baker Mayfield and avoided this entire, and instead they just got absolutely crazy and went nuts and made this trade for Bryce Young. They also passed on CJ Stroud. And so it's like, you could have had some combination of Caleb Williams, CJ Stroud, Baker Mayfield, because who really cares about Sam Darnold? And yet you ended up with a season and two games of Bryce Young, not even a full season, because I think Dalton got in last year for a couple. Anyway, it's the obvious move because you don't want to just punt on your season. You want to try to build something out. And Andy Dalton, who I didn't look this up, but I'm going to guess is 36, 37. Who has, you know, never been special in the league. His best moment was getting the Buffalo Bills into the playoffs and helping break their drought. Like, it's a no-brainer. He's 36. Yeah, see, come on. I got a big brain, Mike Jose. I don't need the Google machine, all right? Let's make stuff up. Anyway, there's no going back here. Like, there's just not. You're not going back to Bryce Young and saying, like, no, this is still your team. Figure it out. They've evaluated him. They're looking at it and they're saying it's over. He stinks. We can't have him just run out there and not be able to play flat out. Like, he cannot play. I know most people probably haven't watched a lot of the Panthers. I watched a good chunk of that Saints game. And it was it's a disaster. It's a calamity. He can't throw. He's a little tiny guy who looks completely broken. His confidence looks completely shattered. And yeah, I can't imagine what it was like in that locker room right now. But yeah, his tenure's over. And I think if you're the Panthers, you try and flip him for what, third or fourth round pick? Is your pipe dream here that you're saying, if we could get something, salvage any type of an asset to a team, then you do it. It's like, maybe it's Sean Payton because his first round quarterback's not going to work out. Maybe it's the Steelers who continue to try to do like the Reclamation Project QBs. I don't know who tries to buy low on him, but somebody will. Someone will still try to take a shot and say, hey, he was the first overall pick. He was successful at Alabama. We're going to put him around some kind of structure. But it's not going to happen in Carolina. You don't make that move and then come back to him and say, yeah, don't, oh, you know, we just wanted to figure out. No. It's over. C'est fini, c'est tout. It's done. It's dead. It's completely done. So now you're just working on the trade. And man, honestly, best case scenario is that you work on the trade this season and you fire him off somewhere else. And then you hopefully pick first in the draft 3 years in a row and you take your next quarterback and you hope that you don't whiff on this. And at least this time, hey, Panthers, if you don't end up with the first pick, no more trading up for a while. Just sit where you are and pick. Just sit where you are and take the pick. Anyway, Monday night. No bigger winner than Kirk Cousins. Like, that's pretty clear and obvious, right? No bigger loser than Mike Jose and his Philadelphia Eagles. It was like the win probability went up there. Boy, oh boy, were they loving the win probability. 99%. It's over. A minute left. We don't even need to run the ball. By the way, before I actually do the Kirk Cousins thing, I actually don't mind the Saquon call at all. Normally, I'm like, you got to, like, I understand the people that are like, you got to run the ball there because then the clock goes down. And if they wouldn't have had that clock, the game's essentially over. Like, That's Saquon Barkley. It's one of the best running backs in the NFL, and he's wide open for a first down. I did see a stat that he's got a ridiculous amount of drop balls over the last couple of seasons, so maybe that does factor into it a bit, into this take. But if it's there, you check out of it, got Jalen Hurts, you give him a read option, you get your all-pro running back wide open to seal the game. Like, I can't really hate on the coaches when it's the players that need to just execute that play. Like, that's purely on Saquon Barkley. I was actually a little happy for Mara, the Giants owner, and I was a little happy for Giants fans because they're living hell right now too. Their sports hell is very real. They just lost a football game that no one's ever lost in that fashion before, where you score 3 touchdowns and you don't allow a touchdown and you somehow lose a game. Like, that's how bad things are for Giants fans. And so I was a little, hey, good. Chalk one up for the Giants. Chalk one up for Mara, who said that he's not going to be able to sleep at night if the Eagles sign Saquon Barkley, and then week one, he's running all over everybody. Good win for the Giants. That was good for the G-men. Good for the G-men. Good for the Maras. Actually, I'm pretty sure the Maras are responsible for no more trash talk in the NFL. They were the family that was like, we don't like it when the players get a first down and then they point and say a thing. Oh, it's just unseemly. It's unseemly. It's uncouth. We don't need things like that. Not in our game, which we obviously grew up playing, the Maras of historic football family. Yeah, so, you know, never mind. Screw the Maras. So, yeah, I don't care that they ran for it. But, yeah, the biggest winner is Kirk Cousins. Like, yeah, the Falcons saved their season, but does that look like a team that's really going anywhere? Like, all the people that bought Falcons Super Bowl futures and got caught up in the Bijan, Kyle Pitts, Drake London hype train again. It's like, yeah, good luck to you. They're probably going to finish third in that division. That would be my guess. Still very early. Still lots of time, but Kirk Cousins didn't exactly blow me away. But yeah, he has that drive, and God, he just settles down the noise, and it's a huge win. And now he gets to be fun dad Kirk Cousins, wearing his goofy outfits on the plane, and the guys get to rally around him, and they're all happy. Oh, Kirk, oh, he's funny. Because man, boy, would the Penix noise have been loud. Because if you could bench the first overall pick in last year's draft, 2 games into the season, with a new head coach, I don't know if he would have had the wiggle room to do that, the financial commit, but it would have been, the clock would have been starting. And if you look at their schedule, like, they play the Chiefs next week, and then I think they play the Saints the week after. I was looking at it this morning because, you know, I'm in that mode right now. I think everybody is, where you're like, oh, if you lose, look at the schedule. If you lose, look at the schedule, because 0-2 is a death sentence, as we said. But yeah, you look at that and you play the Chiefs, and then Pat Mahomes runs you out of the building. You're 0-3, and then you play the Saints, and that offensive juggernaut, you can't keep up with them. I think 0-4, yeah, like, you're turning it over to Penix. And I think that this just this one win has bought Kirk Cousins at least this season. Like, I have a really hard time now seeing it become disastrous enough where they're going to bench him. It's like, I was talking to my buddy Spoons yesterday about his Steelers, right? Like, I think that Justin Fields, if he's 1-1, he's one loss away from getting benched. Like, they would pivot it over to Russell Wilson, but because he went 2-0, I think he's bought himself like a pretty long runway here, where he'd have to be kind of a disaster for a couple of games in a row in order for the Steelers to bench him. And that's the same way with Kirk Cousins. So massive, massive, massive one for him that he's able to come through with that. And yeah, poor Mike Jose. Like, yeah, you got very little time, but did you even watch it all the way to the end?
Oh yeah, I made it. It was tough. So good. I do blame a lot of the coaching. I do.
No.
I agree with you, though. I don't mind the call. I think it is Saquon Barkley. It's not.
You
got to
catch
call.
That ball, Saquon. Yeah. That's if you're wide open and you have an opportunity to seal the game, and you're an all-pro player who is asking for all the money in the world this offseason, you got to catch the football when you're wide open. That's not on the coaches. They designed a perfect play. They had the right call. If it doesn't work out, you can't be like, oh, the coaches. It's like, no, at some point you got to blame the players. That's on the players to execute. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast. Follow on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime, and we'll see you tomorrow on Leafs Media Day. Might be an extended show. We'll keep you posted on that one. See you then.